Reading 5, Part 2, Prologue. With scant hope of material gain, we went because our fathers served before us, because we had heard the stories of their achievements in campaigns long forgotten within the crumbled magnificence of the subcontinent, and of the loyal companionship of her people, the fighting races of India and Nepal. Far from home, we suffered exile. Dumb witnesses of our sojourn, broken statues in British graveyards bear testimony to the children, the brides, and young men, snatched from life before their natural time, who lie below the barren earth, scattered along the frontiers of an empire that is no more, the old aura submerged now by the new. We cannot ever tread that road again. But a little honor remains. A few friends may come to speak for us, the few still proud survivors of Imperial India. Perhaps it one day may be said we bore ourselves honorably. Mankind can only follow the path of its beliefs. We could not do otherwise. S.S. Assay. The first day at sea dawned dismally gray. Though the SS Assay's layout and mahogany furniture were intact, stripped of her chandeliers and rich trappings, she was a bare-bones workhorse more than a liner. My cruise fantasy evaporated, and along with it my grand notion of travelling posh, port out, starboard home, to take advantage of the prevailing breeze. I was lucky not to be strung up in a hammock like the other ranks, poor buggers, squeezed into every nook and cranny over the bilges. My three-berth cabin, just above the waterline, at least boasted a porthole. Dark and cramped, it was better than the troops' quarters. I had a bunk to myself, an ensuite bathroom, even a Batman. Rawlings, Rathbone, and Rose, the three R's, the label stuck. My cabin mates and I were literally in the same boat, same age, equally inexperienced and unsure. In sharing our salty world at sea, we quickly became good friends. "Hey, fellas, my soap won't lather, nor my shaving cream." The lavatory became the heads, or, stranger still, the pig's ear. The mess became the wardroom. Stairs, companionways. We joshed our Batman was a cruise cabin attendant in disguise. He kept our uniforms clean and pressed, ran our baths, did our laundry, and generally picked up after us, his helpless children, streaked underwear and odoriferous socks included. My conscience gave a twinge, though not strongly enough that I took over my own chores. Officer training had schooled me well. A gentleman doesn't do for himself. I awoke pre-dawn my first day, my stomach rolling with the sea. Clinging to the rim of the metal basin, I checked my face in the cabin's bathroom mirror. Its pale, sweaty skin broadcast my nervousness. I was a fraud. My first real command, and my heart raced. I took a deep breath. "This is it, Hugh. Queasy or no, time to go," I muttered. I struggled upright. I closed the cabin's hatch, stepped into the oily-smelling narrow passage, and headed for the fresh air. The Atlantic swell, throwing me from one side of the narrow corridor to the other, did nothing to calm my flipping guts. One hand pressed against either wall to keep upright, I clawed up the companion ladder and lurched onto the upper deck. My detail? Drill officer in charge of PT. 20 stone-faced gunners stood walled before me. Clearly they hated PT as much as I did. I steeled myself. With languorous, mocking, puppet-like flaps, surly, reluctant, they hopped in delayed obedience to my strangled, "End to one, two, arms wide, legs together, knees." I felt sick. I didn't blame their resenting me, a pipsqueak youth half their age still wet behind the ears. All seasoned active servicemen, drafted for another unwanted tour of duty, they were a bunch of unhappy men, newly deprived of wives, sweethearts, and their firesides. I was never quite sure if my orders would be obeyed, or if, in a mutinous moment, they'd toss me over the side. Those first few days, pure hell. Nightmarish, leering men turned their backs on me in my dreams, rudely gesturing, "Up your Khyber!" Some nights, faces loomed an inch from mine, lip-syncing, mimicking my lips' soundless mouthing. I spent restless hours plotting new strategies from the safety of my bunk. Finally, repetition knocked off its fearful edges, my barked orders took on a more masterful tone, and the men resigned themselves to being on overseas duty. Violent waves lifted, dropped, and rolled us across the infamous Bay of Biscay, swilling men's guts side to side and bow to stern, squeezed below decks into the crowded, airless hold that served as a communal cabin. The men had barely 5.5 inches of headroom above each swaying hammock in which green-faced inmates lay too nauseated to complain or mutiny against their grim conditions. It went without saying, the worst of the worst duties were assigned to the junior officers. When my twice daily rounds forced me to descend below decks to that smelly awful place, it took all my willpower not to empty the contents of my own stomach. Once the Bay of Biscay diminished in our wake, the stench of vomit mixed with cleaning fluid was thankfully replaced by the inevitable but far sweeter odor of dirty socks and unwashed skin. The clouds rolled away. The pitching gray Atlantic seas smoothed calm. Life took on the color of the Mediterranean, as did the weather. We exchanged our wool for cool, open-necked tropical khakis. The senior officers relaxed, routine slackened. The troops built a makeshift canvas swimming pool and a boxing ring on the aft deck. Using roughhouse, deck games, and silly horseplay to cool our cabin fever, officers and enlisted men splashed and played together, building trust and camaraderie. Men dunked me into the pool fully clothed. I lost count how many times. A few days more of lazy fun, a suntanned and happier crew steamed in to Port Said. As the SS Assay slid closer to shore, a gagging whiff of heat-stewed rubbish blasted across the shrinking span of water, flaring my nostrils with the distinctive eastern aroma of spice and refuse. The heavy air supported the weight of my outstretched arms like two spoons resting on a bowl of thick pea soup. I leaned forward, careful not to touch the burning rail with my hands as I had the first time. Once was enough. Dazzled by the whiteness of the buildings, I shaded my eyes and stepped backwards into a narrow stripe of shade to join Rathbone and Rawlins. The Assay's engines muted to a low hum, and for the first time since we'd left Southampton, the throb beneath our feet stilled strangely quiet as the anchor dropped, chains rattling, and reined her to a stop. With the stillness, a wildfire, lung-searing heat hit me full face, burning my nostrils, gasping like a beached goldfish, fighting to extract oxygen from an alien environment. I licked my lips and opened my mouth, wondering how a human body could survive temperatures hot enough to fry an egg on. "Cook a bloody joint of beef on the deck, more like," we three R's joked. My shirt quickly darkened with sweat and my shorts stuck uncomfortably between my legs. I wasn't the only one. Forage drips, damped stains spread under every armpit, outlined backbones and buttocks, and wet glued our khaki shorts and shirts to our bodies. Not a pretty sight. "Get used to it, you. Adapt and ignore," I lectured myself and forced my attention to the old-time scenes unfolding on the sea. Before we'd even dropped anchor, a swarm of craft, peopled by men and boys, crowded the ship, shouting and waving, "Sahib! Sahib! Cheap, cheap, cheap price!" Merchant rowed alongside, fobbing off crudely carved camels, glass beads, and fake antiquities with mock broken hearts until the asking price dropped and halved sufficiently to seal a sale. Carpet sellers unfurled rows of carpet the length of the narrow craft, silk shawls, bolts of cloth splashed a myriad of color without ever getting wet. I threw a handful of change overboard and laughed admiringly as young boys plunged into the murky harbor water, disappearing and appearing like so many glistening cormorants. Not a coin escaped. Exploding from the water, clutching their shiny silver trophies. "Shukran, fellows, please, thank you, more," they called, and upending vanished again into the oily, shark-infested depths. The Assay stayed in port just long enough to refuel and replenish her larders. 2 days of freedom for everyone but the purser, his crew. Their job was to buy and oversee the loading and unloading of supplies from the coal lighters, barges, and to ferry local laborers shipped to shore. Kickbacks were the purser's accepted and unbegrudged right, as long as he kept our bellies full. Discreetly juggling the budget to line his pockets, he soon completed his business, pretending insult and starvation suppliers in the souks and hardtack stores didn't put up much of a fight. His patronage was far too valuable to lose. Tinned bully beef and spam vanished from the table, and we gorged instead on channered king mackerel, swordfish, tuna, prawns, and safe peelable fruit and vegetables such as bananas, oranges, limes, mangoes, green beans, and cucumbers. Though we complained, we wolfed fresh produce, discolored and unappetizing brown after an hour's soak in pinkipani, potash permanganate solution. Watermelon plumped up with typhoid hepatitis or cholera carrying human waste was forbidden. Local camel and goat meat never appeared, too flybone. Too worm-riddled. With local rice and flour came weevils and rat droppings. Though the mess cooks did their best to sort the rice before cooking, I sniffed every mouthful for their unique musty smell and searched for their telltale black specks. Cabin-fevered, I counted the hours to jump ship for a long day's overdue R&R with my friends. Another monotonous evening of gin rummy lay ahead till shore leave the following morning. In mid-deal, my name boomed over the speaker. Lieutenant Rose, calling Lieutenant Rose, report immediately to the duty officer. For you, a signal from the fleet admiral. The duty officer handed me the signal curiously. Who is he to have been singled out? I saw his face register. Admiral de Welt requests Captain Hugh Rose to dine informally this evening at Admiralty House. 1900 hours. Launch detailed. I was momentarily puzzled. Then I remembered. The Palais d'Edgemont. Le Turquet, Admiral de Welt's twin daughters. They were pretty. I danced and kissed each one in turn, but as to their faces, I had no memory. I must have made a better impression than I imagined, that they remembered both me and when the SSSA docked in Port Said. I hurriedly changed from khakis into my tropical whites and waited on deck. White ensign and pennants flying, the barge pushed away from the admiral's private jetty and drew alongside. The ship's hull below me dropped as steeply as the cliffs of Sandhurst's Barossa training ground. Under 50 pairs of eyes of those on deck, I swung my leg over the side onto the rope ladder, praying I looked more confident than I felt. Balancing on the top rung, I fumbled for stable footholds rung by rung. In mid-step, my unsuitable dress shoes slipped, leaving me dangling by my left hand. I grappled a rung with my right, aping trapeze artists. I pushed both feet against the ship's side. I swung far out over the water, twisted 180 degrees before swinging back and regaining my foothold. A cheer went up. I flushed red, my head prickled. I cursed my clumsiness, wishing I could evaporate. When I reached the lowest rung, as shrill whistles piped me on board, a petty officer saluted and grappled me to safety with his free arm. My composure somewhat regained, I returned the salute lopsidedly with my right hand. The transition from the Assay's floating world to the civilians on dry land was too sudden for the evening to be much fun. I entered a surreal civilization of silks and women. Or was it the other way around, and mine the unreal? Wooden and oaf-like, speech dried. To my relief, the evening was over as suddenly as it had begun, and I could sink back into the womb of the ship's bowels. Ballooning breasts, shadow legs moving beneath flimsy silk, swirled through candlelit cigar dream clouds until I finally slept. Up at first light, I joined the line of fidgety men by the gangplank, waiting to scuttle ship. Exchanging tales of wicked vice, the chatter was of how to best sample Port Said's forbidden fruit. We'd fueled our imagination over many evenings with celluloid description of scantily clad cinnamon-skinned beauties, tinkling ankle bells, twirling breast tassels, and enticing undulating bellies. Looky only, no touchy, we'd firmly agreed, after hearing gruesome tales of rotting male private parts. Any other activity was out of the question. At last, the announcement came. Permission to go ashore! We bought smutty postcards, paid to watch a show of unspeakable depravity, gawked at the famous Indian rope trick, were mesmerized by the swaying cobra piped from a basket, watched the gully-gully men produce live chickens out of thin air, and ate rose-scented Turkish delight. We wandered the cavernous Simon Arts Emporium, looking at everything from gold and rubies to lampshades made from camel skin. Finally, we settled on impossibly theatrical white straw-stuffed topees and stepped into the sunlight feeling puckered gentlemen of the Raj. As with every ship that hove into view, when the assay tipped the horizon, the dark emporium exploded to a fairground blaze of electric illumination and brassy music. The staff sprung from their sleeping mats under the dusty counters, straightened their none-too-spruce clothes, and readied to charm the very last rupee from the pockets of their sahib prey. In the early light, before the sky blazed blue, and while the air still held its coolness, the smooth sea shone grey as a sheet of steel. Then, shattering the calm, the ship's engines shuddered into life at 0500 hours, and the SS Assay pulled away from her moorings, carefully navigating her prow through the narrow entrance into the Suez Canal. Men lined the rails to watch. The locked gates groaned shut behind us. The forward ones cracked slowly open, letting the rising flood lift us to the higher level of the canal's 120 miles that linked the Mediterranean to the Red Sea. The banks pressed so close, if I stretched out my hands, I could almost scoop up handfuls of its sand. Boys running beside us on the towpaths, and the others slowly pedaling their bikes, kept easy pace with the ship. Even at that early hour, the path was lively with Arabs in dish-dash nightshirts perched sideways on the bony donkeys' rumps. Swinging their bare feet to the rhythmic, dainty trit-trot of their mounts, sticks in hand, they urged their beasts to keep moving, in one last desperate attempt to attract a final transaction from their fast-vanishing market. A couple of merchants laden with heavy bundles of tourist knick-knacks ran, panting beside the ships, shaking carvings and fake antiquities, calling out, "Sahib! Sahib! Best price! Rock bottom!" We overtook a languid camel caravan slung with bulging orange, red, and indigo woolen saddlebags. Groups of men walked trailing a string of three or four camels, tied nose to tail with string looped through nose rings. Way beyond them we drew level with a smaller group of heavily shrouded tribesmen in black, sitting or kneeling behind their camel's hump. Backwards and forwards, backwards and forwards, they rocked in unison with their ships of the desert, and I understood why camels got their name. Bedou, a fellow spectator informed me, a flock of bleating long-eared goats herded by a boy of no more than 10 caught my attention, and by the time I looked back, the Bedou had turned, headed for the empty landscape. Soon they and all living things evaporated. We were alone, gliding in a pale sea of dunes and blue shadow waves. While I strained to see them, the sun rose and scorched dawn's soft light to the harsh glare of day. Such beauty, I wished I were a poet, or, like Vetter, could quote a poem that described my feelings. Quietly watching, imagining, these words flooded to mind, my first poem. Beyond the point where objects can be no longer seen, capsized by shadows indigo, 6 ships of the desert drown, swallowed by sand's pale sea, spiral eddies as from an oarsman's paddles mark where they have passed, then vanish with the breath of eventide. I found a vacant deck chair and moved it into the shade, away from a group of chattering men. I wanted silence. I wanted to enjoy the emptiness alone. The overpowering heat, the still air, and the slight rocking of the ship lulled me to a near comatose state. I moved only to keep my chair in the ever-shifting strip of shade, or lift a glass of lime water to my lips. Foggy with heat, I drifted in and out of wakefulness, wandering paths chosen by my mind. Reality far away, I rode the backs of elephants, confronted fierce tiger, cooled in marble palaces and temples, and skied in the Himalayan snows. Ceaselessly pressing onward, caught in dream's tide, I walked toward the hydrating rain and saw the desert frog stir.